netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Seymour, and welcome to this special podcast just for insider members. This is our way of saying thank you so much for the support you've given us this year. It really makes a huge difference to us, and the insider members just make so much of what we do at FX Guide possible. So what we like to do is give you kind of special one-off exclusives, and this is definitely one of the better ones. This is an interview I did with Alan Bell. Alan's an editor, and his editorial credits include things like Water for Elephants, 500 Days of Summer, which I loved, last year's Amazing Spider-Man, which obviously quite effects heavy. He actually trained back in the days in on Rob Reiner type films like A Few Good Men, which had, you know, obviously Tom Cruise and was just a great film. But most recently he's done Catching Fire, the Hunger Games second film, and he's going to be working on the next two, or he's currently working on the next two, the final two films in that Hunger Games series. In fact, we speak to him on location in Atlanta where he's busily editing the next films in the Hunger Games sequence. So really interesting guy. And what we wanted to do is, rather than just discuss things in general terms, and we have done a podcast with Yannick Sears on Catching Fire, which was great, I wanted to do is give you a real insight into the process of an editor, especially one like Alan, who has a really strong visual effects background. In fact, he's worked on visual effects films as a visual effects artist. And as you'll hear later in the podcast, he still does exactly that. He does a bunch of shots on his own films, and does a lot of stuff that you would consider way beyond what a normal editor would do. He tends to use Fusion at the moment for doing his stuff. He uses it with an Avid plugin, but before that he was on Combustion, and he's just a really talented guy. So when he wasn't editing, or as you'll hear earlier in his career, before he was like really recognized as a major editor, he did visual effects shots and even set up a visual effects company. Okay, but get back to this interview. What I wanted to do is I wanted to get this process of an editor. Like, how does an editor go about doing something? And when I was pitching at this in our internal meeting, I was saying, you know, for me, it's really easy to understand how a DOP and a director work with actors on a set. You know, they'll clear the set and they'll just get the actors to come in and walk it and block it. And then the DP will watch that and work out where he thinks the camera positions should be based on dialogue with the director and what the scene is about. And that's a process we've discussed quite a lot. And then, of course, I understand when the shots are cut and you hand over to visual effects, what the visual effects artists have to do to tell the story and see how it's going to work in the cut. But what I thought we hadn't spent enough time on is the middle bit, right? What is the process of the editor when the editor just gets the material? So we thought we'd focus on two scenes and just sort of zero in on those as a gateway, I guess, to the overall editing process. So I picked one that's very low on visual effects. It's a scene from The Hunger Games where they first turn up at District 11, shot with multiple cameras, but unlike some other scenes, it wasn't really previs, it wasn't heavy on visual effects work. So Alan had to make that work. And I was really interested to know, like, what's his process? Like, just literally, where does he start? And, you know, how does he arrive at what is important or not important to include in the actual edit? How long does that take? The second, to contrast that, was one that did have previs and it was heavy on VFX. But because we'd already spoke to Yannick Sears, I thought, well, let's pick something that maybe we didn't discuss so much with Yannick, away from the mega effects sequences in the stadium, and just focus on a sequence that completely is supported by VFX. In fact, it's half of the scene. And we're going to discuss there Katniss's display in the new training facility when she's shooting at the holographic projections. There's her, and then there's holograms. That's all there is. How do you put that together? Because here, clearly, unlike in the first case, he could just ask for extra shots. He could do anything he wants because they have the huge amount of flexibility of being able to cut away to shots that are virtually completely made up in post-production. But by the same token, when you're on set, not much to cut to. So that's what we thought we'd do. We'd have this focus on these two completely isolated sequences from the film. And as I say, this is a technique that we've developed here at FX Guide, because we figure if you could really drill down and just spend a lot of time talking about sort of one or two individual scenes and really get to understand that, that would be the window that would open up to let us understand how you might tackle things in a more general sort of sense. So anyway, I hope you really enjoy this. I'm sorry to give it such a preamble, but I wanted to just set it up well and truly. I think it's a really, really informative interview. I hope you do too. I'd love to get your feedback, because you as insider members are kind of our VIP members. You are the people we care about the most, and it's what you want, what you like, what you don't like, we'd really love to hear. So by all means, post comments on the forum or just email us. You can email me, mikes@fxguide.com, and I'll pass it on to Jeff and John. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this interview I did just yesterday with Alan Bell.
This is the 75th year of the Hunger Games. The tributes are to be reaped from the existing pool of victors.
I get to say goodbye.
So what do we do?
I think these games are going to be different.
The 75th Hunger Games!
So I should start by saying thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I believe you're on location.
I am, yeah. I'm in Atlanta right now, working on the next two Hunger Games.
So I was really wondering if we could drill down on a couple of scenes from the film so we could get an insight into your process. I think it's easy to talk about tools sometimes and talk in broad brushstrokes, but I think there's a lot of interest in understanding your creative editorial process. And I was wondering if you could pick two scenes. I'm going to suggest we do one that I would not think would have a lot of visual effects in it. I'm sure everything has something. And one that clearly does have visual effects and how that would be different. I'm guessing the entire film wasn't previs. Is that correct?
No, the major sequences, all the giant set pieces were previs. But no, not the whole film.
So let me hope that I'm going to pick one that wasn't previs and one that was. And I was going to suggest we start with the emotional delivery of the speeches to District 11. Katniss and Peter at this point in the story are discovering the thin ice upon which they are skating in terms of the politics of the film. And the reason I wanted to start there is it seemed to me from an editing point of view, being completely naive and just looking at this from an outsider, you would be presented with the option of a bunch of different choices for how you might want to approach editing that. So stop me if I'm wrong here, but you would have had camera angles on the tributes, families, the lead actors. They'd be doing wide establishing shots, probably shots of the actors that were behind the scenes reacting to what was being set out on the stage. There's a lot of material there. I don't know what your shooting ratio is, but let's assume like any film, it's pretty healthy.
Yeah.
You're given all of that and you're about to start that scene. I really want to know, where do you start? Do you just watch everything? Do you start with a wide? I mean, how do you...
I mean, basically what, you know, with a scene like that, you... Well, the first thing I do is I watch everything. I mean, you know, I certainly watch all the circle takes. So, and a scene like that is generally shot over a number of days. It's not all done. It's sort of like, you know, they start shooting on a Monday and you may, you know, you'll see one set of dailies the next day. And then after maybe 2 days, the bulk of the scene is done, but then you're sort of waiting for second unit to maybe get some of the, you know, the crowd shots or the shots that don't have your major actors involved. And maybe they shoot, you know, they shot the backstage stuff in a completely different location than the exterior stuff. So that all kind of comes in and I'm watching dailies as we're shooting. And then once I have it all, I generally don't start working on a scene until I know that it's complete. I mean, I may start if I know that we're just waiting on a few insert shots or something, but I make sure that I have 99% of the dramatic footage before I do anything. So the first thing I do is I watch it all. I watch all the circle takes. I'll often have a discussion with the director during dailies. Francis loves to watch dailies during lunch. We typically will, you know, we don't have enough time at lunch to watch all the dailies, so we tend to skip around a lot. But, you know, because he's just shot it the day before, he has a real good sense of you know, what he has and what he wants to see. And we'll have a brief discussion about what he's thinking. I'll read the script for that particular scene, and then I'll look at the script notes. And as I'm watching, I'm making copious notes. But more importantly, I'm actually just trying to find out what I think the anchor of the scene is. And in this particular film, because the entire movie really centers around Katniss Everdeen, she tends to be the anchor in 90% of the scenes. And in this scene, she really is, even though PETA kind of takes the lead at the very beginning. You know, he agrees to kind of read the cards and then only after she's taking a look at Rue's family does she decide that, oh, you know, I really have to say something. And she's impressed by PETA. You know, this is sort of the part of the movie where she's starting to see that, wow, like she, the words don't come to her the way they do for him. You know, he comes up with the idea that, you know, to share their winnings with the families, which is something, you know, you could see on her face when she sees him, she's impressed by that. So, you know, I just sort of explore the footage. I get as much information as I can from whomever, you know, knows about it, you know, the script, the director, if the writer's around, I might even talk to them. In this case, I sort of sketched out the entrance with Effie Trinket, you know, opening the doors and the mayor, you know, announcing them and then walking out and seeing all the people. And of course, when you, there's actually were quite a bit of effects in that scene because everything off the stage, you know, when you're behind the actors and you're looking out, it's essentially just a boulevard and some train tracks. And there was maybe, I don't know, a row of, you know, peacekeepers and five people back. And then that was shot, all the depth of people were shot in like eight passes. So I'll just cut without any of that stuff. And I don't bother trying to comp any of it in while I'm editing because it would just take too long. And I just kind of just pretend that it's all there. And of course, there's trains going by and cars going by the whole time. So you're constantly hearing trains. And that's a little bit can be distracting. But
at this stage, are you worried about pacing and beats? Or are you more worried about, well, where are the key performances? Because I've got to say, for me, one of the things I loved about this in your edit in this is the most emotional thing to me is the reaction shot of Katniss, not Peter's speech. It's her look when she's got no dialogue, right?
Yeah,
That is the turning point.
I mean, basically, that's what you're trying to do when you're, you know, I wish I could say that I look at the footage and it all just comes to me and I put it there and it's brilliant, but that's not really how my process is. So what I generally do is I'm trying to find those moments. And when I'm looking at the dailies, I'm looking for those moments. And I'm also trying to sort of, you know, in a certain way, decode what the scene's about and what those little nuggets are, because they're very easy to overlook, you know, when you have this huge mountain of dailies. So what I'm doing is I'm going, pouring through performances, and I'm trying to find out what the scene's really about. And then I just start structuring it together. And I tend to anchor it on specific beats and performances. And I don't worry too much about pacing. Things start off, you know, loose as I'm cutting, because I don't really care about matching. All I care about is how something makes me feel. And I try to approach it from that perspective. So, you know, it's been so long, I can't remember exactly how I sketched it out. But
well, Alan, sketch me the scene for a second now. You're at this stage alone? Are you with assistants? Are you watching this stuff on a big screen? Are you just looking at it on a laptop? And what are you
basically
working like?
My cutting room is set up like a screening room. So I have an HD projector with, it's not a huge screen, but it's about 120-inch diagonal screen with an HD projector. And I work with a 24-inch Cintiq tablet and a Apple Ben monitor, you know, just a regular big Apple cinema display. And I sit back in the room so that it's like I'm in a theater. It's almost looks like a little mini mixing stage. So I'm usually alone. I do have assistants who come and go, but they're usually preparing the next day's dailies or sometimes doing sound work or other things that they need to do. But I'm usually in the room alone. So I'll get up at like, you know, I'm in the cutting room usually by 8:30, and I try to get everything watched, you know, by lunchtime or long before, depending how much I have. And then I just get to work. And
what's the sound that you're dealing with here? Is this just like wild sound of them delivering the lines? Because that could affect your view of the material, the performance.
It's the sound is sunk. So it's often, you know, in this case, I think people had labs. And then there were also booms. And I believe in a few cases, in this case in particular, I'm sure the microphone that they were speaking into was live. So it didn't go out to the crowds, but it went into the audio recorder. So I have, you know, there's usually three or four channels, but usually I'm cutting off of a single, you know, maybe it's a group clip. If it's multiple cameras, it's a group clip of some kind, but the audio is a single mixed down version where the actual onset mixer recordist is deciding which sounds better at any given point in time. And so like if you're recording four tracks, he's mixing down to one and I'm cutting with that. And if I need to go back, I can pull out the other channels.
And your back end on this is enormous in the sense that there's a massive Avid storage system that means that you're not having to swap stuff in and out. You could almost reference anything if somebody wanted to see
anything. I have every take that's been shot. I mean, the way it works in the cutting room, we've got on that show, I think there were five Avids while we were on location, and we had something like 36 terabytes of storage space, or maybe a little less actually, but certainly enough to hold the entire show and actually the previous film. So, because there were a few scenes from the other film, so we had tons of that space is not a problem at all.
And because one of the reasons I mention that is, and I'm not telling you anything you wouldn't already know, which is when people are doing indie films, like when I'm cutting something, right, it's nearly always the last takes, the one we use, because quite frankly, probably only got it right on the last take. But in a with serious actors who are, well, in this case, Academy Award-winning actors, but the actors of this caliber, there's going to be performance differences that are nuanced, that are maybe, you know, playing against each other, that means that, you know, a performance probably wouldn't be assessed in isolation. It'd be assessed as part of the emotional arc of what's happening with the other characters at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you have to have every take. I mean, even, you know, like I said, I watch the circle takes, but that doesn't mean I only cut with the circle takes. So I will typically start, as I'm watching dailies, since I've only watched the circle takes, that's what I start cutting with. But as I go down the, you know, towards the finish line of the scene, you know, I'm watching it over and over again, and it's slowly taking shape, and I'm finding out things about performances and about, you know, oh, look at that look. That's really great what she does there, what he does there. And, you know, each time you kind of make a new discovery and you patch it together, you learn things about how that relates to other takes and other things that you've previously added to the suit. So you then go back and look for, you know, oh, wouldn't it be nice if he didn't look away right then, or didn't blink, or didn't do this one thing, or, you know, what have you. So then you end up, you know, going back to the well and digging out other takes and stuff like that. In terms of structuring stuff out, like a scene like that, I basically focus on the speech first. So, and don't worry too much about, you know, who's looking across at the families, that, you know, the lines sort of dictate, okay, you know, I didn't know him or I didn't know her. And, you know, when they're referencing the families, then I'll cut to the families and just do it in a real sort of straightforward way, to start with. And then I just go layer after layer and start to figure out, okay, when do I want to go back into the room? What level of, you know, comedy is appropriate? When can I use it? When can I not? And of course, the whole scene is building up to this kind of giant faux pas that Katniss makes, which, you know, is the exact opposite of what President Snow expected her to do, you know, leading to the death of this old guy who salutes her. So the idea is to build up as much, you know, it's doing a bunch of things. You're trying to create a sense of her warming up to PETA and sort of recognizing what he is. I mean, because, you know, it's building off of the earlier scenes where he's like, look, we have to be, you know, we can't just be at each other's throats. We've got to be friends. And they're talking about, you know, their favorite colors, and they have this kind of lighthearted thing. And then they end up in District 11, which is, you know, it's like, you know, the other side of the Berlin Wall. And things are not great there. And she sees how comfortable PETA is, you know, giving that speech. And then she's, you know, she's looking at the families and she's genuinely moved. That's a shot that, you know, that scene where we manipulated quite a bit to kind of make sure that she was looking in the right directions. I mean, I think I did a few split screens in there just because sometimes you get, you know, a performance on one actor when you're in a two shot that you really love the reading, but the other actor maybe wasn't doing the same thing that they did in an earlier take. So sometimes I'll split them and just to get their heads in the right directions and make a match or, you know, get a little more emotion out of it. We did a little bit of that.
So staying with that for a second, if I'm not mistaken, and not that the book is gospel beyond belief, but it is very faithfully reproduced in the films. In the book, it's pretty much Katniss's point of view. What we know as an audience, we know from Katniss knowing it.
Yes.
In this particular scene, for example, you cut behind the doors to have the, you know, can he do that? He just did kind of line, which obviously is something Katniss wouldn't have been aware of. How significant a stylistic decision is that to make? Is it just like, well, look, we're going to bend the rules, or it never even came up in discussion? It just felt right.
Well, in that scene, it really didn't come up in discussion. But certainly we had a number of discussions about that. There's no doubt about it that when you are leaving her point of view, the movie feels like it's kind of lost its course, because it really is. I mean, to be true to the books and be true to the story, it's very, very, it's her, she's the central character and it's what she's experiencing. Something like that, it's such a quick piece, and because they're looking at we didn't really talk about it. And my feeling about it is that because it's a direct reaction to something PETA just did, and she, you know, she reacts to it first. So like he does it and she looks, and then they go back, wait a minute, can he just do that? It's kind of like, it's just a little bit of like, let's blow off a little steam here, get some Effie Trinket comedy relief in there. And then also point out that what PETA did wasn't allowed, you know, so it's giving you a little bit more information, but it's not taking us so far off course that we're actually traveling down a road without her. You know, we jump right back out again.
And while I think that it works, and this is not a criticism, but you did actually go off for these scenes where Snow and Plutarch are discussing the nature of the game. There were scenes that the screenplay had that the book didn't.
Yes.
It's one of the few occasions where we really do get a perspective way beyond hers.
Yes.
I think they worked. I think they were really valuable and great actors giving great performances.
Yes. And we had discussions about those things. And I think that basically, because in nearly every instance when that happens, they're talking about Katniss or something that Katniss did, or they're worried about, you know, something she might do. It's always in relationship to her, even though she's not in the scene. So I think it works a little, you know, because it's informational, but it's also giving you, you know, adding character depth to people that she's going up against. But you're right. It's not, you know, it's not like we're just sticking the camera with her all the time, but it sort of worked. And, you know, one of the advantages of a movie like this with this book series is that the author is very involved with the filmmaker. So, you know, very few choices are made willy-nilly. It's not like she's been cut out of the process. She's very, very much in.
Oh, no, yeah.
And that, I think, you know, I'm not in any of the meetings, so I can't really say how it works, but it seems to me like they're all working very, very good at preserving, you know, the intent of the book, which, you know, there's writing and then there's filmmaking. So, you know,
absolutely. And can I just ask you one other thing about that while we brought it up? Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance in that particular scene I'm referring to where they're discussing, Katniss and tightening the screws on District 12, and by the same token, contrasting that with her wedding. I heard remotely the recording of the director talking at an event, and I think he said that some of that was improvised. And I was just going to ask you in general terms, or specifically to that, when I believe Philip Seymour Hoffman improvised, is that something that, you know, you kind of look for those moments where an actor decides to express themselves, or just, you know, it it doesn't really matter to you whether it was improvised or not, is I guess my question.
Well, yeah, I'm looking for stuff that feels real and natural. And so if it's improvised, I mean, I think he's a phenomenal actor. And
oh, yeah,
it's just completely. So much fun. I mean, gosh, I'm just so blessed to like have been on a movie, and still I'm on movies where every single actor is at the top of their game, and they're, you know, every take is great, and it's just fantastic. That particular scene, I can't remember the exact, you know, like what the lines, which ones were improvised and what weren't. But the thing about that scene that I think is great, and I still love about that scene, is that you get this sense that those two guys really like each other. You know, they're talking about that, but they're laughing and they're enjoying each other's company. And that was the thing that when I saw the dailies and I saw how Snow was behaving towards him, and, you know, it was just like, even though they were really creepy, they were at dinner enjoying each other. And I just think that like really stacked the deck against Plutarch, so that by the time, you know, you find out, if you haven't read the books and you don't know where it's going, and, you know, if you are on the journey with Katniss and you go in, you're in that hovercraft towards the end of the movie, it's really powerful when you realize that, oh my gosh, this guy has been manipulating this whole thing. And when I saw the scene in the dailies and his performance and the way those two connected, I was like, that's what I was going for. It's like, I want to make sure everybody understands that they're, you know, they're going to tighten the thumb screws, and this is the purpose of what they're doing it. But I also, it was really important to me that it really felt like they were having fun together.
It did certainly make it less like you've got one evil maniacal genius off to the side and more of a system that was against her, yeah. Which I think was great. And of course, as I knew the book, but yes, it would definitely have steered you away from believing that you knew it was going to come. So can I go back now to District 11? Because I didn't mean to go off at a tangent over that, but I was interested in your answers. So we've established that you've done this cut around the dialogue, and you've obviously got some stuff that's feeling natural in the flow. But give me a sense of how long on a scene like that, District 11, you'd like to be left alone before you want to show it to somebody else. Well, and is that first the director?
No, that's not really true, because all my assistants, I constantly have them coming in the room and I show them stuff. But it's a very tight group of people who get to see early cuts. It's just the people who work for me and the director and anybody that the director deems, you know, I should bring in the room and show something to. So, you know, in a case like that, I think that scene took 2 days to shoot. Maybe, yeah, about 2 days to shoot. So usually if it takes them a day to shoot I give myself a day to do an assembly that I'm not embarrassed to show somebody. It may not be, you know, something that I think is polished and ready to show the studio, but certainly something that I can show the director and say, you know, is this what you were thinking? And get notes and criticisms from.
Do you like temp music?
In a scene like that, no. I mean, I do like temp music, but I generally don't work with temp music to start with. I try to get the scene working as good as it possibly can before I start laying music in. Now, if it's an action scene, then I'll often have music that maybe not even be the perfect music, but it'll give me something to pace to. But it's very rare that I'll cut a dialogue scene and put any kind of temp music in to it until I feel really confident that I've made all the right choices. Because one of the things that does, at least in my view, is, you know, I could sit and look at a blank wall with a great piece of music and I'm happy as can be. And that is a really great blank wall. But, you know, if you take the music away, you realize you're just looking at a blank wall. So that tells me all I need to know about music and editing. I just feel like it's better to get the scene to play and to play as good as you possibly can and then apply music afterwards. So you're taking something that works really well and you're making it a lot better than taking something that's kind of works, but isn't firing on every cylinder. And then you add music and it's like, whoa, this is great. It's very hard to get something paced up and make it efficient when you've got this music that's overriding how you feel about something. So I'm careful of that.
And along the same lines, and it's probably not so relevant in this District 11 scene, but there must have been other scenes where the grade that you were going to end up, that I would see in the cinema, radically different to what just happened to be shot for whatever reason. Do you like to have a temp grade on there? Is there any risk that people are going to fall in love with images that don't have a temp grade and then be off-put when they start getting graded closer down to the finish?
I like to have things graded. And the reason why is because, you know, the DP is looking... He has a look in mind, and generally speaking, it's a little bit more difficult to achieve this in film than it is in the digital realm now. But, you know, Catching Fire was shot on film, and Yo went to fairly great lengths to make sure the dailies looked as close as possible to what he wanted the final film to look like. We even regraded a lot of stuff. It's certainly, for me, it's very important that technical things like that, where, you know, you're cutting from one close-up to another, and if the grade isn't right and they're not matching color-wise or temperature-wise, you know, that can really just take you out of the scene. And since, you know, the director of photography is spending so much time trying to get the movie to look as good as possible, I think that the closest I can have my footage represent his or her vision, the better it's going to be. And I just, you know, something like that, I think, is really good to front load if at all possible.
So I've worked with editors who are great editors, and so this may sound like I'm being sarcastic, and I'm absolutely not, but they've like asked people to leave the room and we've come back later and it's a better cut, and I swear they've made just one single frame, like they've cut a frame out like to make a difference in something. And it's a noticeable difference, and yet I would have completely dismissed that that was even possible. When are you getting to that fine-tuning stage where you really just want to get it exactly right? Like, how long after this process is it going to be? At the very end of the film, you're going to come back to each scene, or are you going to finish the scene before you move on?
Well, we the way Francis works and the way I work with him, and I it's really the way I prefer to work, we go over the movie repeatedly. So we, you know, I'll get a scene basically. I mean, here's how the workflow works: is while they're shooting, while I'm cutting as fast as I can and trying to polish it up as much as I can, I'm also chasing camera. So I don't have time to burn. And I know that, you know, one of the things that I do that people might not be aware of is as they're shooting, if I am putting a scene together and it occurs to me like, wow, we need, you know, a shot because we're missing something here. There's a beat that's missing. It's important that I'm able to communicate to the director that as soon as possible and show him what I mean by showing him the scene as soon as possible before the set is struck or they have to move on or the actors, you know, fly away or whatever. Part of my job is to make sure that we got everything that we need before we leave the location. So kind of racing camera. So you're trying to, you know, you have to be efficient and fast as an editor to do that part of the job. And if it can be polished, that's great. But I do that knowing that this isn't the last time I'm going to be on the scene. You know, I know that I'm going to go over this stuff, you know, repeatedly. I mean, granted, there are some scenes that are small, they're very self-contained, you cut them and they tend to stay the way you originally cut them. You may trim them up, drop a line here or there, do some minor polishing, but you know, there are a number of scenes in every film that, you know, my first cut is the cut. But really, every scene in every movie that I work on, I'm going over repeatedly. And sometimes we start at the beginning of the movie and we go all the way through to the end and then start over again. Sometimes we move things, you know, we start later and then jump around. Certainly on a movie like Catching Fire, you're jumping around a lot because you have these huge effects turnovers that you have to do. But no, we it's a process. So it's not like I don't just cut it and then throw, you know, leave it to the side and then go back to it in a month. It's sort of when we're doing the very first pass. So like once the director's done shooting and he comes in and we look at what we've got, we just roll up our sleeves and start working. And we hit on every single scene. And when we're done, we start over again. And we just keep at it until we get it to where we think it's good.
This is probably the dumbest question I'm going to ask you all day, but is there any advantage, you obviously don't have the time, but is there any advantage if you did have the time to actually go on set and experience some of these takes not through the eye of the lens?
Well, the advantage isn't, there's some advantage, but really most of the advantage I get, because I'm really more preoccupied with what's in the lens and what's in the, on the soundtrack than all the other peripheral stuff. I'm spending a lot of time around set on these next two movies because I'm actually cutting in a trailer. And so I do go to set a lot now. But when I say a lot, like once a day, I may go drop in and say, hey, what's going on? And the advantage there is that it's much easier for me to communicate with the creatives on set. And, you know, I really do believe that a large part of my job is deciphering what the intent of the material is in the director and the actors, because it's not always evident on the page, or they come up with something that isn't on the page that, you know, maybe only exists in one or two takes that need to be combined in a certain way to create this thing. And, you know, those are the things that when you're on the set, you can kind of learn about, that if you're just locked away in your room, if the director doesn't, you know, think to mention it to you, you might miss. They can seem like trivial little things, but at the end of the day, they mount and can be very important to a scene, like the emotional connectivity for the audience and for the characters within the scene. Does that answer the
question? Well, if I can, yeah, no, it does. Can I jump then, Alan, to discussing an effect scene?
Sure.
And I want to deliberately discuss an effect scene where, I mean, obviously there's a lot of great effects work in this. And we could discuss it in terms of differences in terms of IMAX or non-IMAX or that kind of stuff. But I just want to go to a scene where clearly there's a bunch of stuff that has to be added in later because it couldn't be there on the day. Because it's a different editing problem than the one we just described where you're just looking at all the rushes and that's pretty much what you've got. So let's pick something that isn't obvious, like the training sequence with the holograms. Because we know that there are no holograms there. So you're having to make something. I'm wondering how much is that sort of a you following the map of the previous? And I'm also interested in your relationship with Yannick. We've spoken to him separately about the visual effects sequences. But I don't want to get a sequence that's so big that it had to have been done away from you a bit, like the rotating of the island in the game. So how much was the previous done on that, say, training sequence with the holograms and the arrows?
I can't really recall any previs, but there was the stunt actors went through and made sort of a video of what they figured would be happening in terms of her routine. And, you know, that was made in like a warehouse somewhere. And, you know, the guys jumping off.
So this is without the actress. This is just them.
Stunt people. You know, wires and, you know.
And filmed from a sensible angle or just as like a reference so that people would know what's going on?
More or less from relatively sensible angles. I mean, you know, they got video cameras and they actually edited it together and did some temp After Effects stuff. And it was actually fairly impressive. So I saw that. And then, of course, they shot something completely different. I mean, they didn't shoot. It wasn't completely different because the routine was the same. But, you know, you get there with the DP and you're on the real set and you've got a real director. You know, it's different.
Well, you'd hope that it would be. You'd hope it would be a new collaborative experience.
But at least, you know, I had this guide, so I knew essentially what the idea was. And I believe that Francis, although I haven't spoken to him about this, but I believe that he looks at those videos and uses them as an example for himself, like something like oh, okay, so that's what that looks like. Now here's what I'm going to do. And so that scene basically, you know, it's this routine that Jennifer Lawrence learned, and each shot was numbered. And I think originally there were like 12, 15, I think there were 15 different sort of arrow shots that she makes. And I think by the end of it, we eventually cut a couple out, but each one was very, you know, was numbered, and there were plans about, you know, where the threat was going to come from. And Yannick had showed Francis this really cool, I'm not sure what the technical name for it is, but it's essentially where they use these lasers that once they cross, they superheat the ions in the air, I guess. And so there is, the technology exists actually to create those types of holograms. And he showed me some video of this stuff. And he goes, it's going to be kind of like this, but you know, it's going to look better. And so I kind of understood that, okay, there's going to be a whole bunch of lasers moving around. And when I first looked at it, I cut it together, and I was kind of making it more like an action scene. And one of the things that when I first, you know, a typical thing in the action scene is if somebody sees a threat, you see them react to the threat, then they fire. You know, it's like a 1-2-3 kind of thing. It like they see, you see the threat, they see the threat, action's taken. One of the ways that Francis likes to tell stories, and I think it's fantastic, is we see the threat the same time our protagonist sees the threat. And so there's an awful lot of stuff where the camera is right behind the actor, or we're sweeping with the actor just as the threat comes into view, and then they're taking action. Well, when you do that and there is no threat, it just seems like people are kind of, you know, it's almost like they're dancing, you know, but where's the partner? It's really difficult to tell what's happening. And so I recut it sort of in this way. And I showed it to Francis, and he's like, I don't, you know, it's still not quite right. And what I realized was, because we didn't have anything to really see how the timing was, how it was going to work, it was hard to really know if the timing was right. You know, is there enough time for that threat to sort of materialize and get over there? So I, just because I'm crazy, I one weekend, I basically built the set myself in Cinema 4D, and
wow.
Got a Microsoft Kinect and hooked it up to my computer. And I just hand tracked, you know, I did 3D tracks, but just by hand, because I didn't have time to do tons of rotoscoping. So I knew the dimensions of the set. And once I built that box, it was relatively easy for me to do real simple sort of camera match moves in Cinema 4D. It didn't take me long at all. So I just laid out each one after I had the cut the way I wanted it. And I just acted out with stick figures, just like, you know, little tubes with balls for joints and a ball for head, no feet, just balls, you know. And so I made each threat and put them in the position that I thought they, you know, they were going to be in. And once I did that, I showed that to Francis, and he was like, oh yeah, it's a lot better. And we could see where I needed to adjust the timing. And I had the advantage of being able to adjust the timings before I even showed him. And so once we got to that point, then Francis is like, hey, let's get Yannick to come in. And then so Yannick and I worked together on it. And I think Yannick and I did a couple of sort of back and forth passes on, well, what if we did this? What if we did that? And he's just got a fantastic sense of story. You know, he's not just an effective guy.
Tremendous supervisor.
You know, he really, I love working with people like that, because he's always asking why, you know. And he did some, there's actually, I'm going to a different scene, but there is one moment that he did that I think is brilliant in the monkey, in the drill scene, where there's at one point when Katniss is just about, she's out of arrows, and this one Drill comes running at her, and it was supposed to like jump on her, and she hits it back with her bow. But Yannick's like, well, there's no way, like the force of that drill would knock her over. Like it's there's just no way it would recoil like that. There has to be a physical reason why that drill would go in that direction. And he was right. He ends up making it so it's like a glancing blow, and the monkey kind of goes off, and she's not as destabilized, and it actually physically is right. And because of that, it's very believable. And where I think a lot of other VFX supervisors would have, the previs shows the monkey goes up and hits and she knocks it back. We would have ended up with that in the movie, and there would have been something that maybe you couldn't put your finger on, but it wouldn't have felt right. And
I'm really fascinated by this relationship between you and the VFX supervisor, because in these sequences, like the one you're talking about, or the one we started with, the training center, it's a tremendous opportunity for you to just to ask for extra shots. I mean, I know you said you could ask for extra shots in something like the District 11 setup, but it's a bigger deal. Whereas if you decide that it'd be nice to have a cutaway of the way those simulations sort of dropped into cubes that then sort of scattered on the ground, you could just say, well, I'm going to drop that shot in there. No one's made it yet. The opportunity cost of you doing it is virtually nothing. It just needs you and a decision, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there are, when you're making a movie like this, it's not like it's a bottomless pit of money and you can do anything you want. But at the same time, before you've really dedicated enormous amounts of resources, there is a period of time when you can be very creative and you can kind of horse trade shots. You can decide, well, this isn't as important as this. And one of the things that's great about working with Francis and working with people like Yannick is that they understand that process so well, and none of us get hooked up on, shot counts or, well, this is how it was in the previs, so, this is what the studio agreed to. And like everybody, we're all trying to make the best film we possibly can. And, Yannick understands that, well, okay, this sequence is going to be about this big, and let's, the VFX producer maybe bid for X number of shots, and maybe we have one over, or maybe we have a few less. Like, nobody's getting too up in arms about that stuff, really just focusing on the story. And when you have people who are creative and they're not just thinking about only the technical aspects, then you get this sense of collaboration. I mean, one of the things that's, typically in Hollywood, there are hierarchies in filmmaking. So, you've got the studio and your creative producer and your director and the editor, and then across from me, not below me, are people like the VFX supervisor and all the other talented people that go into making, the sound designers, the composers. Typically, because the picture editor tends to be the go-to person. If you don't go to the director with something, everybody comes to the picture editor. And I think a lot of picture editors kind of take ownership of this sort of like, they're the gatekeeper, and with that comes a certain amount of power. I choose to look at it as, if I'm going to comment on the visual effects, then it's incumbent upon me to allow the visual effects department to comment on my work. And I never get upset when somebody has an opinion of my work that I don't necessarily agree with. I've never learned anything just by isolating myself. So, I welcome other people's input on the cut, and I expect my input on their work to be welcomed as well. I mean, obviously, as long as I'm not being an asshole. So that's how I approach working with people like Yannick, is that, this is a guy with a wealth of knowledge who's very interested in story, but also is an amazing creative tactician when it comes to doing this stuff. And he has ideas about the movie that I can learn a great deal from. And I think that when you approach things like that with mutual respect, the end result is better than it would be any other way.
So in this particular sequence we've been talking about, you had to do an official turnover, and that turnover was to hand the shots on, I think in this case, to Fuel to do the visual effects. Right. Is that something that you have anything to do with after the turnover other than getting the shots back? Is that all just from Yannick, or do you actually have any kind of loop through discussions with anyone from Fuel, their supervisor, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I didn't talk to anybody at Fuel directly myself. Pretty much everything goes through Yannick in towards Fuel in that direction. But one of the things that we did is, you know, we took my sequence, which is actually quite difficult to look at. You know, it's these gray stick figures that are, you know, they're like OpenGL rendered, because I'm not going to sit there and, you know, spend a bunch of render time. They don't look particularly good. And that sequence then got sent to Fuel, and then they started doing some look development. And once they got sort of the look the way that Yannick liked, he would show that to Francis, and Francis would show it to me, and we'd discuss it. And then they started doing sort of a process that was like a high-res version of Previs. So they started getting these characters animated, but still at a point where they knew they were going to get more timing notes, and, you know, like, this isn't ready for final yet, we just want to see how it feels. And we all reserved the right to sort of make adjustments to the cut, and we did so, you know, at each step of the way. Whenever a new iteration came, the VFX editor, Ryan Turner, would get that material, he'd cut it in, and then usually it went something like this. I was busy working on something else, and then Yannick would go, hey, Alan, you know, there's 12 new shots in the training sequence. Do you want to look at them? And then Yannick and I would go look at them. Usually Francis had left for the day, and we'd go check them out, and we'd talk about them, and I would make an adjustment or two. And sometimes that meant, you know, rolling some of the animation to change so that it just timed out better. Sometimes it meant rolling some of the live action. Sometimes it just meant trimming or extending something so something could take place a little bit better. And we just kept sort of working it like that until we finally landed on the sequence, and then decided that it was a little too long and we needed to cut some out. So we cut a couple shots out that just felt sort of repetitious. And I think there's maybe like 9 or 10, I can't remember, maybe 12 arrows are fired now as opposed to 15. But we just developed it over time. And it was very much,
but it's not just Cinema 4D. You've got a Fusion set up, yeah, and a Avid plugin for your Fusion that allows you to actually, so because you are very fluent in visual effects. I mean, you have IMDb credits as an editor, obviously, but you also have IMDb credits as an effects guy.
Yeah, I mean, I've integrated Fusion into my Avid workflow because, I mean, here's the story with me. Is I started out in editing. I was an assistant editor, and I started doing visual effects as an assistant editor. And I realized that I had a propensity for it, and I quite enjoyed it. And when I decided to become an editor, I went from working on these, you know, big budget movies, making pretty good rate as a first assistant editor, and I suddenly was on these indie movies where there was more money in the budget for the Avid rental than there was to pay the editor. And I mean, literally, you know, I wish I was joking, but I'm not. So I realized, well, you know, one thing indie films love is the ability to do things that they, you know, wouldn't normally be able to do. And there, at that time, there was, you know, films were still made on film, and every movie, no matter how small or how large, had an optical budget. And those optical budgets were, you know, usually, even on small movies, somewhere around 80 grand. So I started learning how to do visual effects on After Effects. And I started studying color science a little bit because I, you know, I knew that I had to know something about log color space and how to make sure I got film, you know, DPX or Cineon scans at that time, and get them in the right color space, do two-dimensional work on them that was typically optical work for the most part, but do it digitally. and then get it back out to film and have it match the film print. So I taught myself how to do that, and that was a way for me to earn a living while I was telling the world that I was an editor. You know, I could do these indie films, get some of the money for doing the opticals, and I started getting so good at it that other people started hiring me to do shots in their movies. And that was great because, I mean, when I did my very first film, as a solo editor, not with like shared credit with anybody, it was this movie called Bait, directed by Antoine Fuqua. After that, I went like a year and a half without working. And if I didn't have these capabilities, I don't know what I would have done for a year and a half. And I know what I noticed is the assistants that decided to become editors, the ones who went out and did their first film and then eventually went back to assisting, never really became successful editors. And I believe that it's because the people that you work with when you're an assistant don't view you as an editor. And they're really never going to. I mean, there are rare circumstances where these exceptions happen, but for the most part, you're rebuilding an entire group of, a network of coworkers and people who would potentially hire you. So, you know, I spent 12 years as an assistant, and, you know, I've been the last 14, 15 years I've been editing. And so
let me ask you about that, because you're an assistant on films that I loved, like Misery and A Few Good Men. Mm-hmm. Apart from an aesthetic appreciation of the editing process, you're saying that it wasn't necessarily a direct stepping stone to being a full editor, because those are great films. They're well edited, they're well put together, they're, you know, good directors.
Yes. Basically it works like that. I was very fortunate because I worked on Rob Reiner movies with Robert Layton, who up until very recently had cut every one of Rob's movies. And Bob Layton he still is. He's a very close friend of mine. It's actually his birthday. Shout out to Bob Layton today. He mentored me, and he was very, very good about teaching me how to edit. I mean, he let me cut scenes on film at a time when, you know, cutting scenes on film meant, you know, here's a roll of film, sit down on the Kim or the Moviola and start literally cutting. And, you know, you make a lot of bad cuts when you're first learning. So let's just say there were a number of rolls that needed to be reprinted after I got my hands on them in the early days. But, you know, Bob was really good about nurturing me, and he shared credit with me. I co-edited a couple of Rob Reiner's movies with him, and he really let me explore editing, but he also used me as his sort of technical go-to person. So if there was anything visual that had to be done, he expected me to figure out how to do it. And that gave me the wherewithal and the impetus to learn visual effects and enough about color science to where I wasn't stepping on the files. Because at that time, it was much easier to really screw things up than it is, say, today.
But even as recently as 4 years ago, you were doing 500 Days of Summer, which I loved, which was an editing project. But you're also doing stuff on films, I think Duplicity as a supervisor, as a VFX guy.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't...
That's only like 4 years ago.
I mean, I opened up a, you know, like for instance, 500 Days of Summer, a small company that I owned, I did all the shots on that movie as well as edit the movie, except for one shot, which is the 2D bird flying. I did a 3D bird because I'm not a 2D animator. I can't draw very well. Because I had these skills, I started a shop that just does what I call a very specific type of effect. And I call them performance enhancing visual effects, which they tend to be split screens, paint outs, beauty fixes, time warps, split screens mixed with time warps, set extensions. I can take still frames and turn them into, motion pictures, stuff like that. So once I learned these skills, I started applying them, and my other editor friends and post supervisors saw that I could do it. So I just started doing it, and I opened up a business to do that. My business is still, it's operational, but I'm not really running it anymore because it's at the point where it's just too difficult. I'm spending too many hours in the cutting room.
But on a film like Water for Elephants, for example, were you actively doing some effects work in addition to being the editor, or had you moved to just being an editor?
I pretty much moved to just being an editor, but like on a movie like Water for Elephants, I hired a crew. I mean, Paul and Zena from Crazy Horse did 99.9% of all the effects in that movie. And I was happy to have them do it. They're fantastic. But there was a portion of visual effects. The problem with me, the good and the bad, is that I tend to generate anywhere from 60 to 200 invisible shots in any given movie that I work on. So, I mean, that's just what I do. A day doesn't go by that I don't do a split screen. I don't slow something down just maybe in one portion of the screen. If I want to drop a character's line but not cut away from the shot, I'll take that character. I will roto them out, slow them down, use a still frame, and morph them from themselves into themselves and then out again. And it'll be totally invisible. You won't know that I did anything to it. Yannick will know. The VFX supervisor will know. And the people at the VFX shop that have to actually make it look perfect will know. They're probably pulling their hair out. But I do that on like all the time. I mean, it's just part of my process because I've gotten to the point where I'm a relatively good compositor. I mean, if I just spent time compositing, I could do composites as good as any other compositor. But as I'm editing, I've discovered that, I can't make things look perfect because my first priority is the editing. And all I have to do is show the director and the visual effects supervisor that what I'm talking about doing is viable. It's possible and it can be invisible. And 90% of the things I do using Fusion and a whole bunch of other tools in my toolbox are geared in that direction now as an editor. So
I got to ask you the question, does that extend to the point that on Amazing Spider-Man, you were doing those in stereo?
Yes. I mean, I did some crazy stuff on the Amazing Spider-Man. I mean, insane. I mean, I took one scene in Amazing Spider-Man and turned it into two scenes. So I basically cut one character out, and that was one scene, and recut it. Then the other character, I used what I had left of him to turn it into another completely different scene. You could do a whole like huge story on that, but I don't know if Sony would want me to.
It all works for the story.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
This is the point of the exercise.
Exactly. And it's I actually think there may be something on the Amazing Spider-Man, the extended features on the disc. I think you can see the original scene I'm talking about. And it's pretty easy to sort of look at it and go, hey, wait a minute. That looks like it was shot in the same place with the same, whoa. And you could sort of put two and two together. But I just do that all the time. Now, I mean, in Spider-Man in stereo, I typically would, like if something complex like that, I split the eye out, I do it all in just one eye, and then I duplicate that eye and just make it flat and worry about the stereo part later. Cause I'm not really doing final when I'm editing and I'm working in the Avid and I'm using Fusion Connection and I'm doing that type of work. It's not final footage. So I'm not, I'm not trying to make it look 100% perfect. Now I think I did like five final shots on Spider-Man just because I could, and we were really running down to the wire that were kind of fun, but where I actually used R3D files and finished the shots in stereo and gave them to ColorWorks, and they ended up in the movie. But for the most,
one thing before we move off that, just for a second, I remember reading an article with you around Spider-Man, and I think one of the points you made then, which I thought was really interesting that I haven't heard many other people articulate, is the reason that you liked working with stuff in Fusion versus, say, a DS or even Avid's own effects tools is you said there's two aspects of it, and I hope I'm paraphrasing you correctly. It isn't just being able to pull off an effect. It's being able to pull off an effect so that when I have to go back to it to either reuse it or adjust it, that I can actually, me or somebody else can understand what the heck happened.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't just like, well, because there are, you must know this, there are editors that will pull off stuff in an edit that are almost indecipherable to effects artists as to what they did or how they did it. It's just a patch and a hack and a patch, and it just becomes a nightmare later. This isn't how you work.
No, I mean, here the thing that's pretty great about the Fusion Connection pipeline, the way it works, but first off, I started out with After Effects. That's really the tool. I mean, I really started with Photoshop and then moved on to After Effects, and so I had a layer-based mindset for many, many years. And I think you may know I was really into Combustion for a long time. That was sort of my go-to tool for.
Well, and Toxic, I'm led to believe, yeah, which is a whole other discussion we can have.
Exactly. That was sort of the end for me. I kind of shy away from Autodesk products at the moment because I'm just tired of getting the rug pulled out from under me, and I'm not going to spend, you know, I'm in that weird area where I can't afford a flame, and I'm not going to go down the smoke road right now. So I basically, the thing that you get, if you just did your visual effects in the Avid, you know, you could do a lot. They're not very good. The tools aren't really, they're just really, really old, and they don't really always work the way you would imagine them to. So it's very hard. You know, you could do something and then come back to it 3 weeks later and try to tweak it and completely break it and spend hours trying to figure it out. The same is true with After Effects for me. When I get really complex comps, it's very, very hard for me to tell, you know, that I'm passing something through four layers and it's affecting something down. It just takes a long time to sort of decipher these big things. And with After Effects, you end up with these huge batches of pre-comps, like comps that require other comps that you wouldn't normally really need in a nodal-based compositing program. Or if you did, it would be, they're very, very, you know, they're all in the same tree and you could tell what's happening. You know, this is saving to here and then that's now flowing over this way. So the advantage of a nodal-based software like Fusion or Nuke or Shake is that essentially, you know, you've got your there. It's a path. It's like a stream. You know, this goes from here to here to here.
It's like a recipe.
Yeah, there are arrows, and it shows you very easily what happened. It's very easy to look back and decipher and figure out what you did a month, 6 months, a year ago. The thing that's unique about Fusion and Connection and the Avid that really saves time is that not only can I tell what I did, you know, a year ago, when I actually have to do it, all I do is put an in mark and an out mark. I don't even need that. I just basically have a clip. I drag a plug-in and I throw it on to a layer in the timeline, and a message box comes up and says, how many layers do you want? And, you know, if I put it on the top of three layers, I just hit three, and then I export those clips. I just click one button and all three of those clips get exported into a predetermined path. I don't have to worry about where it went. I mean, I've already preset that up and everything goes to the same place. Then I hit edit effect, Fusion opens up, and there's a comp there with three merge operators. It's set up for me. I get to work, do whatever I'm gonna do. I hit render. I don't have to set a saver or anything. I hit render. And as soon as I hit render, I can go back to the Avid and start working again. And as soon as it's done and it's propagated, it's now in my timeline. So what that plugin was showing, the underlying footage before, it's now showing the rendered output of the saver in the Fusion file. I then have to render that piece in the Avid so that everybody else on the network can see it. But that only takes like a couple seconds. Once it's rendered, it's done. Everybody on every Avid can see that rendered piece of material, and it's there. It's just the housekeeping part of it alone saves me easily a half hour to 45 minutes a day, because, you know, in the past, what it meant was I would have to export each one of those layers individually. When I did that, I'd have to decide how I wanted to name it, where I was going to put it. Then once it's there, I've got to go into whatever app I wanted to use before, import it, set up my savers, do my work, render that out, then go back into the Avid and import it from where I rendered it out to, and then cut it into the timeline. All that's done for me.
It's really the difference between having a non-creative process automated and having to do it manually.
Yeah, I mean, and it's to the point where now, you know, it's like, I mean, the directors I work with, they get what I can do, and I think that they like it. They certainly seem to, because they're constantly asking me to do it. Like, oh, can you do that thing? I'm like, yeah, don't worry, we'll get on it. And, you know, they want to know how long it's going to take, you know, because sometimes they prefer to sit. Look, if I can do a split screen really fast and it'll look good, I mean, you get to the point where you can look at the material and you go, okay, yeah, I can track something here. There's not going to be tons of road. Like, I know how to do this really quickly. And then you can look at shots and go, oh, yeah, no, this is like a half hour shot. Well, when the basic easy shot that you know that you could do in 5 minutes has 10 minutes of housekeeping involved, suddenly, you know, the director's like, well, what the hell is going on? And you haven't even begun work. You're like, well, you know, it's just not that much fun. Your job isn't really going the way you want.
Which I guess comes down to the fundamental issue of experimentation, which I guess is the only bit we haven't really hit on yet, which is, you know, this is opening up you to allow you to experiment, because the tax of housekeeping isn't so great that it's a complete waste of time to try something.
That's right. And, you know, that's a good thing that you point out, because a lot of what I do is experiment. And I often, you know, I will sometimes try something and it won't work. I mean, a lot of times I'll do things, and part of the experience is, okay, well, I tried that and I know that's not good for the movie. You know, I'm very happy to come up with ideas and cut them out of the film. And a lot of times you can't know, you know, if something's going to work the way you want until you actually get those two pieces of image together and see how they're going to marry or not, you know, particularly when you're doing things like morphs. You know, it's not like you can't.
Well, yeah, and it's vastly cheaper if in an editorial you can experiment with that stuff rather than turning stuff over to an effects house, seeing an effect shot, deciding that it isn't what you want in the film, and then binning a completed effect shot. That's like, that is certainly a waste of time and money.
Yeah, no, it is. And the reality is that, you know, most of these things that these types of things that I'm doing, you know, they're being played in audiences are seeing them and they're unaware that they're seeing anything at all. I know that it's a little bit of a headache probably for the effects, you know, people like Yannick and his ilk, because, you know, he's on a movie and he's got 2,000 shots to deal with. And then here's this pipsqueak guy who's got like another 75 shots. And, you know, they're not always trivial. I mean, that's the thing that, you know, they may look invisible on the Avid, but when you actually get down to it and you're trying to do it in 4K, there's man hours involved in some of these things. They're not always that simple, particularly.
Well, especially if you shoot some IMAX in the middle of all.
Yes.
This.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole nother ball of wax. And then, you know, speed ramps are considerably more difficult than people realize in terms of making them look perfect and not artifacted everywhere or jittery or both.
Yeah. And yet, clearly, this is the way it's going.
Yes.
And I'm sure you'd agree with me that an editor coming up, you know, if you could speak to you today, if you were a junior version of you today as an assistant editor. I mean, those skill sets are incredibly valuable.
Yeah, they really are. And, you know, the thing is one of the things that I heard a lot from the old timers coming up that I really kind of, you know, I questioned a lot. You know, there are a lot of people in this industry who will just tell you left, right, and center, story, story, story. And they're absolutely right. But when they're using that as an excuse for not learning what the tools are capable of and becoming deft at the usage of those tools, then they're short-circuiting their own capabilities a little bit. Because
no one would suggest that you don't light a scene really well because it's all about the performance and not whether or not people have interesting lighting on.
Exactly.
Them.
But I mean, there are a lot of people who will use that as an excuse, like, well, I'm a creative editor. The guy who knows how to push all the buttons is a technical editor. It's like, well, okay, learning how to push the buttons, that is technical. I'm not disagreeing. You know, it's not necessarily easy or fun for everybody to understand how these things work. You know, the Avid is a complex piece of software. So is Final Cut Pro. So is Adobe Premiere. Any editor who knows how to use any one of those programs can pick up the other one very easily. It won't take long. You know, that's not to say that if I'm super fluent on, let's put it this way, I cut many features on Final Cut Pro, and when I switched over to Avid, I was a little nervous that when the director was in the room and I hadn't, you know, had a few days to like get up to speed on the Avid, that I would look like a knucklehead, you know, like, oh, you know, how do I get into trim mode? But the reality is, you know, after a couple of days, I'm just as efficient on Avid as I ever was on Final Cut Pro, as I'm sure I will be on Adobe Premiere one day. And, you know, I've gone from Fusion, you know, I'm at Fusion now, but I've, you know, I went from After Effects to Combustion to Toxic. And I've, you know, played around with Nuke. So it's like, once you understand and you wrap your head around these tools and you spend enough time with any one of them, you know which questions to ask. And for anybody coming up, if they're not really taking a long look at what these things can do and asking themselves, how can I manipulate time and performance, then there's going to be a whole bunch of other people who are asking those questions, and they're going to be more competitive, they're going to be more successful. And ultimately, this is a service industry. I am at service of the director, the producers, the studio, and ultimately the story and the audience. And so anything that I can do that will make those elements happy and the movie better is just going to service me as well in the end.
Well, look, I want to thank you so much for taking time to walk through your process with you. I know I was kind of really hammering you on details, but we do love to hear the details behind the stuff that you're doing. And congratulations on the films, because they really are. I can't wait to see the next two. It's a crying shame I'm going to have to wait 2 years for the second one. But hey, you know, that's filmmaking today. Yeah. yes, it's, I look forward to seeing how you go. I know that the books get bleaker. I'm obviously not giving anything away by saying that. It's not a trade secret. So there are obviously new challenges, and perhaps later after you've completed either the next one or the one after that, we might be able to talk to you again, because it's been a great delight talking to you today. Thank you so much.
I love your website. I actually met you at, NAB like 10 years ago, I want to say.
Oh, really? I'm embarrassed about that. Sorry, I'd forgotten. Where was that?
I think I was really big on the Creative Cow website early on, and I was there when Ron and Kathleen from the Cow had a booth, and I think you did something in a hotel room where you were broadcasting something, and I was there with you and Jeff and what's your other partner's name?
John Montgomery.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I sent you that.
Well, you'll accept my apologies. Obviously, we get to talk to an enormous number of people, but if I my sincere apologies for not remembering.
Well, that. it was quite long ago. But I really enjoy your site, and so it's a pleasure.
Well, thanks again. And as I say, we're looking forward to the next films. Much appreciated.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Last year was child's play. This year, you're dealing with all experienced killers.
Any last advice?
Stay alive. The real enemy is.
Well, I want to thank Alan so much for that interview, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. As I said at the outset, we'd really like to get your feedback. You are the most significant members of our FX community, so we'd really like to hear from you. Please email, as I said before, or post in the forums. In, you know, anything that you want to say, we'd welcome the input, because FX Guide's been going now for a really long time. It's grown enormously, but we've done so on the basis of getting great feedback, good and bad, from people. So if you like this kind of stuff and you'd like to hear more of it, please go right ahead. But if you'd like to outline something else you'd like to hear, we'd love to respond. And as insider members, I can guarantee we pay enormous attention to what you guys have to say. Well, that's it. Have a really, really great holiday period. And for Pete's sake, travel safe so that we can see you again in 2014. Until then, on behalf of Jeff, John, myself, and all the team here at FX Guide, have a very safe and happy Christmas period. Bye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.